Europe is complicated. Much like Poland. Previously in Europe, petrol cars.
And now to sunny, sunny Greece. Athens, specifically. Mm-hmm. As the nation of Greece has returned to the bonds market. Mm. Ooh, which is not terribly exciting, now that I've said it out loud. But this is important. As Greece did try to re-enter the bonds market, 2 years ago, 2015?
It was 3 years ago. I think it was early 2015. Yeah, so
it's, okay.
This is the first time in 3 years they've tried to sell bonds. So
right, yeah. It might have been 2014 then. Anyway, 2 years ago, they tried to sell bonds, and that didn't go well. And now they have returned to selling bonds. Mm. Athens has opened its financial markets again. Lots of pictures of men staring at charts on big screens, with Greek letters all over them. That's always good. So response to this has been kind of mixed. General kind of gentle praise of being like, oh, Greece is back on its feet, or this is a good sign. Some people are warning others to not be overeager, that this isn't the end of the financial crisis for Greece. And other journalists being kind of contrarian, or the typical, well, actually, kind of argument of, well, remember 3 years ago when they did this and it all went to shit. So mixed response kind of thing. Only time will tell. You were saying before off mic that some ratings agencies have said that they are, you know, in a better position than they were when they did this last time. But then you also pointed out that the ratings agencies also said that everything was fine in 2007. So,
So kind of like Tsipras, the Greek prime minister, is, you know, obviously saying this is a good thing. It's his idea.
Look how great we can govern, kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But like, as people pointed out, like, it is 3 years ago, and that was after a four-year absence from the bonds market due to the like initial financial crisis. And like, a lot of the core problems still exist, like their debt to GDP ratio is very big. The rumors of Greece will probably need a bailout when this one expires again. Aren't off the table. Like, it's still a big possibility. So, kind of, you know, this is a good way for the country to raise money, but it's not a sign that Greece is like in good economic position suddenly. Anyway, possibly better than they were like a year ago, but you know, that's a pinch of salt.
The bailout program is meant to come to successful conclusion August next year. So they have another year of like negotiations and talks and stuff. And hopefully should be all wrapped up. I mean, that's what their finance chief, Pierre Moscovici, is saying. Moscovici. I think they're being, like, there's a lot of, like, comments coming from the government being like, oh, look how great we are and how brilliant we're doing.
Yes.
But I think those are, like, the big sound bites. And then if you actually look at more extended interviews from less public members of the government, they're kind of like, oh, we're doing this cautiously, and you know, there's more bailout stuff to happen. This isn't the end.
This is like all part of a process. It's not
exactly, it's not the silver bullet that fixes
makes for good headlines though.
Yes, absolutely it does. And you know, morale boost, and a lot of this kind of like, all this stuff can be influenced by how confident people in Greece are of the economy, that they're willing to spend money. And then if that confidence goes away and they don't spend money, well, then of course the economy's going to be shit.
It's a vicious
cycle.
Yeah, we will see, I think, more on this later. But and now over to our we need a better name for this section because it's become kind of recurring. It's the
I love the big boys section.
Yeah,
it feels like I've gone shopping.
Or the twin engine section or something along those lines.
Twin engine section's nice. It rhymes.
Yeah, twin engine section. So this is talking about Germany and France. There's like kind of mid-level news in both of them that we're gonna talk about. So the first bit is kind of about revisiting the like light touch on the German election.
Hmm.
So the SS, like Schulz was out in Italy and to meet with the Italian prime minister and discuss like refugee planning and stuff and making speeches on rhetoric of stuff he'd do. Kind of a recurring problem in Schulz's campaign so far has been he suggests things that are very similar to what the government is currently doing in Germany, or it's something that the Christian Democrats have angled for anyway. So it's not like proposing like a fine like line between them. It's Schulz saying stuff that sounds sensible, but it's something that Merkel has possibly said in the past, or someone in the government has said in the past, because like a lot of the government is the SPD. So yeah. Schulz is often saying that, giving speeches in kind of the in the tone of, oh, this is like a reform I want to make, but it's kind of not dissimilar to what they're doing now.
Mm.
Yeah, so I guess like the part of the problem is like he comes up with good campaign speech points, but then they oft aren't translating super well to actual policy that's showing like a proper divide between two options.
Yeah.
Whereas Merkel is now just focusing on like security things and like spreading. Make like prosperous Germany for everybody, etc. Like kind of
the usual stuff you say when you're center right party.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas
keep the recovery going. Very reminiscent of Fine Gael's platform.
Yeah, I think the like part of the problem that Schulz has specifically with this is that like, unlike in a lot of countries where the center right government often does stuff that like are quite right leaning in certain ways. And this is similar to the UK with like a lot of social issues, is that like the centre-right party is actually just centre-right on those policies. They're not super right-wing on things unexpectedly. Yeah. So like in the UK, the Conservatives are quite right on like fiscal and social services things. But like gay marriage passed while they were in government. And while like you could pick on a lot of individuals, especially people who previously had like reservations about stuff like that, and again, you have this in Germany, like it in exactly the same way, as in Merkel herself isn't pro gay marriage, but she's not like forcing the issue anymore against it, and like things of that nature. It's not like a hard right push on like principled, idealistic social things that they can pick at and say like Merkel's doing this thing that you all agree is bad. Vote for us. It's very like they actually are center right. They're not secretly quite right on things. They're quite centrist on a lot of stuff. So it's hard to be like sensible and moderate on things with like a left wing twist and actually make that look different in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I guess this is kind of the big comparison would be the United States, where their like two party system is way more formalized.
Yeah.
Whereas what we have in Germany and the UK is basically the de facto two-party system.
Yeah.
But it's still, like, the reason you don't have these crazy right-wing ideologues, like, not a huge contingency of them in the Conservatives, is because UKIP is permitted to exist, like, and
yeah, no, but, like, but you, yeah, but you do have those people in the Conservative Party, but they're, like, they're often, like, career politicians who are like pragmatic enough to understand like the benefits they have of being part of the larger system that disagrees with them on like some points. Like in the same way that like for years you had, while the center of the ruling Conservative Party in the UK was pro European Union, large portions of their party were against it.
Yeah, that's a more accurate divide within Conservatives, and then you have like a New Labour, Old Labour divide within Labour.
Yeah.
But then like, yeah, I guess it's, I think in the United States, I feel like this stuff gets a bit more drastic with like parties within parties type of thing, where you have like the Tea Party, which is quite big, and it's where a lot of the like social policies of the right in the US like kind of come from, and where you get that very easy to demonize the Republicans kind of aspect from, which it's super easy to do. Like it's not hard. They have some wacky opinions on things, but
I think like the absence of stuff like that, and Merkel not personally being like very unpopular for it, like things like that, makes it quite difficult for someone like Schulz, who is quite charismatic and, you know, is, you know, getting a reasonable amount of enthusiasm from some wings of like his supporters. It's because of the lack of unpopularity and like clear things to point against that they differ on, that the like main, like the leader, like the leading party in the coalition are doing, it's difficult to like imagine how like a big swing could come from it. Another problem with like, especially with his comments this week that are like reasonably moderate on like needing to plan better for refugees, like in Italy where it's a big problem, is like the only people, because that's not super differing from the current government's position, the like, if you disagree with Schulz on this, but you agree with the SPD on a lot of stuff, this is kind of just pushing people to that's only going to push people away. Like, as in, this is kind of, he's effectively concurring largely with the current government. So it's kind of, for people who wanted a change, it's making the SPD not really seem like one. And like, there were some commentators who were suggesting that this would give the AfD, which is the very anti-immigrant party in Germany, which we talked about in the past, hasn't been cashing in on like its polling gains in a lot of places, for instance, and like kind of is weakening a bit. Stuff like this actually is where they specifically very like are like a very clear other choice if that's a big issue for you.
Well, it's a very similar story to how like a lot of Labour safe seats went to Conservatives largely because a lot of traditional Labour support in the UK went to UKIP.
Yeah, yeah.
Because UKIP championed themselves as the real party of the working class, etc., etc.
Yeah, and like, if you disagree with Labour, like core, like the like centre Labour party on their immigration stances, we're offering you an actual difference, whereas the Conservatives effectively agree with them on the majority of it.
And
like, most of the, like, odds are the person you got to vote for in your constituency was probably like quite a like moderate conservative on refugees, etc. So yeah, not really a massive difference from Labour. Anyway, moving on. So that's kind of, I think there's like some consensus on Schulz's campaign, even though it is still early on, but not really, it's edging closer. of kind of a disorganization and lack of clear messaging.
I keep feeling like the German federal elections are far away, but they're not.
No, it's now. Wait, when this comes out, it'll be August. No, yes.
Yeah, so it's 2 months effectively, because it's the end of September.
Yeah, so it's actually really not that far away, considering like there was a Schulz bump, and that's like whittled away, and effectively nothing's happened since. So,
and also, if we were talking about the French election 2 months in, we would have been like French fever.
Yeah, that's true. Stuff really isn't taking off in the same way. But I guess that's more, I don't know. Presidential elections are easier to latch on to like clear developments, whereas like rumblings are very hard to gauge. Cool. Moving on to, so kind of this week, the German and EU anti-cartel authorities are now apparently investigating Mercedes-Benz, Volkswagen, BMW, Porsche, and Audi for allegedly holding secret meetings together to discuss like technical standards, working together on suppliers to get like, you know, cheaper metals and stuff for their cars, and possibly price fixing on some level. Not necessarily for like domestic, like affecting German consumers, but so that German car manufacturing would be more dominant against foreign competitors. So the idea of, oh, we could like band together and agree on some pricing that would make it that our German cars are now very cheap to buy versus like UK cars in some country, or like, you know, Japanese import cars or cars manufactured. Yeah, exactly. Like lots of other, like you could do it to edge out like in certain markets, like Volvo, the Swedish car company, like have a niche, but like with sufficient planning and releasing like technical spec, if you kind of work vaguely together on technical specifications, you could edge them out by flooding a market. I'm not super up on like the very, very like specifics of exactly like what aspects of, you know, sharing technical stuff and working together to possibly strong arm suppliers into lowering prices. Like exactly the specific cases they're looking into, and it's possible they haven't released it. But it does kind of seem like, for instance, like one of the things that they might have been collaborating on due to this happening of Porsche during the week, that people might remember the Volkswagen emissions testing scandal, where it turned out they had effectively like a software that they could turn on and off a feature that would make the car more fuel efficient, however, and with lower emissions, however, it made the car much less good as a car. Because, like, as in, it would make the engine would be much less performant if you had it on. So you'd have it on for the emissions testing, and you have it turned it off for all the performance testing. So the car will have both low emissions and high performance in somewhat like an unbelievable manner. The kind of consensus from like a lot of car companies seemed to be like, yeah, well, we all kind of figured they were doing something like this, and now it looks like Porsche were also doing it, which leads possibly to believe this might be something that they were potentially collaborating on. Was they'd all like someone somewhere had worked out a good way to cheat EU standards for emissions and then share with the German companies, so it looks like all German cars are really fuel efficient, right, and or have low emissions, and foreign cars don't. So that's not great.
That's kind of an important news story, because I often hear the argument online. I know it's a great place to get your arguments, but still.
That, the best like, arguments.
That a lot of like antitrust cases pursued by the European Union very much has a German interest bent.
Yes, or often like an anti-US multinational bent. Yeah, like specifically.
Yeah. So I think this is important that we actually like talk about this, because that disproves that idea. I think there's been other cases in the past where Volkswagen have been told to pay. Volkswagen seems to keep coming back up and up and up again.
So it seems like potentially the way this investigation started was whistleblowing from people at Volkswagen after the emission scandal, where possibly staff at Volkswagen were kind of like roughly aware of potentially something like this happening. And then when they got burned for one thing, it was like, well, this is clearly the next time we got burned down. We need to get ahead of this. And or, like, so, yeah, someone, like, vaguely, you know, aware. And then once they found out about the emissions thing, they were like, what else are we doing that's possibly suspect?
That are we the baddies?
Yeah, right.
So that's an interesting one. This is vaguely reminiscent of a term I learned a while ago, which is oligopoly. Which I love that term, because it's such a fantastic word to say. I did say fantastic. Where it's basically a monopoly, but it's done through agreement of several companies that are supposedly competitors, but they're like working together in backdoor deals to like keep each other all around in favor of getting rid of other competition. Yeah, that's not great. And as someone who's looking to move to Germany, I can tell you that their car standards are ridiculously high. So I'd hate to find out that was all a lie.
This is part of the problem with you kind of see this like amplified online, but there is also the kind of stereotype of there's lots of EU regulations that effectively the Germans are going around policing, saying like, oh, we do this, our standards are X, so everyone needs to meet them. They make that the EU standard, and then no one else can meet these seemingly like unattainable standards, and the German like version of that product is the only one that exists. I tend to believe that he's wrong with this, but like James Dyson rails on about this all the time, saying that the EU keep coming after him for like claims he makes about, or like this company makes about like suction of their vacuum cleaners and stuff. And it's like, well, that only works under like this very particular power condition, which isn't what we're testing. We're testing this much more common condition of attribute usage, and we're going to use that. So your claims don't make any sense. And his claim is like that, well, that's like the way he sees it is that's not what everyone he's been graded on a different curve, which is the kind of opinion that people often tend to have. And it might this might be a case of the Germans tested so well on this, not necessarily because their product was as superior as they said it was. It might be better, but it's not better in the way that they said it was. It's just if you have enough people working on the problem, you can figure out how to cheat the standard.
This is completely off topic, but I hate Dyson, like the man. I hate the product. He's a fucking swindler.
they make really good hand dryers.
Sure, I'm sure they do, but their vacuum cleaners are garbage. I hate them so much. They're just so stupid, and just no matter how much stuff comes out online, is how much like little bits of logic. I was like, well, if their vacuum cleaners were so good, why aren't thousands of companies trying to rip them off? Why are like all these other massive vacuum cleaner companies sticking with conventional models? Like, oh, copyright law. I was like, okay, but then why isn't China doing it?
I don't know. You can buy other Valve vacuum cleaners. Like Samsung make one now, and there was a court case of Dyson trying to sue them, saying they stole their like some core part of their patent.
Yeah.
And there are knockoff Dysons, but like the knockoff Dysons are like very bad.
Yeah.
Samsung also had problems with the EU, like that particular model had problems with like it not meeting EU power standards, like cuz they have maximum power your things allowed to pull to be like a vacuum cleaner to like for energy conservation reasons. Mm. I think Dyson always like comes off quite badly cuz you need like a lot of power to do their way of vacuum cleaning. Anyway, not super important, but that's fine.
Dyson also said this week that like no Brexit deal would be fine, and they're like, oh god, no, shut up, Dyson, shut up.
Yeah, well, he's grumpy because they keep calling him on his spurious claims.
Good. I like this next week on the I Hate Dyson podcast.
Yeah. No content, all editorial.
Sorry, go on.
So moving up, because this is our twin engine section, we're going to talk about Macron very briefly. So Macron has hit the thing that generally happens with French presidents once they start actually trying to do stuff. His poll numbers have dropped quite significantly. This is kind of, it's like, this is a bigger drop than you saw with like Sarkozy and Hollande, who had similar drops at different times. But I think the difference here probably is that it's dropping not like due to like the election sheen wearing off. It's because he's now enacting the stuff he said he was going to do, a lot of which was never going to be popular. I think he's aware it wasn't going to be popular, which is possibly why he's doing it as early as possible while he has the opportunity to. So, like, one of the things that this has been pinned on is a decrease in some housing benefits, which affects, like, a large number of French people. I think it's, like, a €5 a month drop in a particular type of housing benefit, which affects millions of people, including possibly a lot of students, which is potentially problematic because they might now protest his big changes to labor laws that he's planning to push through. This is kind of not super unexpected. In the same way, this is part of the reason like Hollande's opinion ratings were so low, is that he lost a lot of the support of the left due to him trying to push through labor reforms, some of which were possibly planned while Macron was his economy minister. So Macron pushing this stuff through, causing his poll numbers to drop quite sharply, isn't surprising, but just, you know, it's notable that it is happening, and that, you know, young babyface Macron is not like the super popular president people some people might have expected him to be, but this is due to the stuff he said he was going to do, him doing them has proved to be unpopular.
I guess the other, I think we talked about it before when talking about the French elections, but the big difference between Macron going after the same labor reforms as Hollande did is that I don't think Macron is trying to present himself as a left-leaning candidate.
No, exactly.
Yeah, left of who he was competing against, sure. Yeah. That's not hard to do.
Yeah.
But, like, he is... I think Republic on March is going to be the new... Well, I'm not sure what the state of the center is in France, but like a Lib Dem, very centrist party.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, I mean, that's, I guess that could work in his benefit, that he's not really lying about his party's ideology, goals, and etc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but like, I feel like there was a lot of people who, I also think there's were a lot of support for the like, I don't know, Communist Party came from. In like the last election, were the people who would not go any further right than the socialists, but mm-hmm. the socialists had betrayed them.
Yeah,
yeah. It's. I'm very interested to see how this happens, but the looks of things, it might affect him negatively as well,
or not. Who knows? And now, hopefully very briefly back over to Poland again. A somewhat surprising development in, so we've been covering this last 2 weeks, was the very broad, far-reaching judicial reforms that the government somewhat surprisingly kind of announced, because I think people weren't expecting the scope of them to be so extreme. Like the big tickets of them was the justice minister of the current sitting government would be able to effectively fire everyone on the Supreme Court and replace them with whoever he wanted, which is a big deal. And the other ones were like letting them stack the body that promotes judges and selects new judges, I believe, with like their own picks for that board, which again would make it that the justice minister effectively controls who becomes judges, etc. The president in Poland has effectively, I think he's signed everything that they've sent him in this parliamentary session, with maybe one exception. He hasn't vetoed anything. So he's vetoed one or two out of the three laws that were sent to him, including the one that effectively let them replace the entire Supreme Court, saying this is like, you know, part of what he was saying about it was that this was removing the independence of the judiciary, which is unconstitutional and not really in line with the idea and not really genuine judicial reform. He did pass one of the bits which lets the justice minister control lower courts a lot more than they currently do. Which is still a big deal, but it's less like, you know, they're not being able to, like, part of the issue with this was that the Supreme Court in Poland certifies election results. So if you're able to put whoever you want on the Supreme Court just before you have an election, you could just, like, theoretically you could just have them say the election was void if you lost. So that's not really a good precedent to be setting. And kind of that was in due to the president's rhetoric about it as well. So I guess, yeah, one of the things I want to talk about on this is like a lot of the coverage, I feel like you're losing, like, doesn't have the context of the state of the Polish judiciary, because kind of like Duda's large point in this was that there does need to be judicial reform. It's just this is the incorrect type of judicial reform. This is just you controlling the judiciary, which is not actual reform. So now he said he's going to put forward his own proposals for like a reform package. But like based on his alignment with the PIS, the sitting government now, like the content of that might end up being quite similar to the content of this with some changes. Like it might still involve the current government having like tighter control on it, or potentially the president might have tighter control of the judiciary. Who knows? So this is, that's interesting in that, this was kind of in wake, like, he vetoed this in wake of large scale protests, against these reforms. And somewhat vague, somewhat specific threats from the EU that they would like propose sanctions on Poland, temporarily remove their voting rights in the EU if they pass these exact reforms. Whether or not the reforms that they did pass are still possibly going to involve the EU, like pushing back against them, is unclear. But yeah, kind of the big ticket bits of it have been vetoed. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, the main point I wanted to make on this was that I think, yeah, like a lot of coverage of this, it's easy to think about. You hear Supreme Court and you think of either the judiciary in your country, or perhaps influenced by television, the judiciary in America. Yeah. Whereas, like, there seems to be a lot of consensus in large bits of the Polish media and like politicians who aren't currently in the sitting government that there does need to be judicial reform, and the judiciary in Poland has a lot of problems. It's just that this was the wrong way of doing it, which is kind of echoing what, like, you know, Duda said about it when vetoing it. I think there is, it's very easy to kind of read headlines and assume, oh, this is the PIS trying to control, like, take over the courts with no reason to be doing so, and the courts should be left the way they are, which also isn't true in Poland. So yeah, I think it's easy to see it in light of, oh, but in my country, this is how this would work, and the Supreme Court works like this, and that's a good thing. And it's like, well, there's not the context of how the Polish courts work, and people seem to agree that there are problems that needs fixing. So
I think it basically comes down to a lot of the media in our countries, in the West, outside of Poland, basically, are framing this as judicial reform versus status quo, where it seems to be like judicial reform versus another form of judicial reform.
Yeah, there does seem to be appetite for some sort of like change to the status quo. But the status quo isn't, it's not, that's not working. It's just not what people, well, not what it's intended to be.
Garbage UK section,
which we call Garbage UK section because basically all of the news out of the UK lately has been like infighting in the cabinet of the British government, and like what we expected for Brexit talks was like slow moving like international talks about treaties, which is what is happening. But people, because this was like a hot topic and the idea of talks starting was, you know, oh, the talks are starting, big deal. And it's like, yeah, but they're EU talks. They're going to take a while. It's going to be pretty slow moving. There's not going to be a lot of news out of it.
Yeah. People want a blood sport.
Yeah. Which isn't how EU talks work, which I think is partially the dryness of EU talks tends to be a problem with EU talks.
I want to point out this picture in The Guardian of the UK's Brexit Secretary, David Davis, and the chief EU negotiator, Michael Barnier.
Yeah.
They look identical in this photo.
They do look identical, except David Davis is leaning forward in an aggressive manner.
Well, yeah, David Davis looks like he's been slightly defeated. Begrudgingly.
Yeah, Barnier is just like, I'm not fazed by this at all. Negotiating is my job. Why are you tired?
We're just getting started. It's like when you go working out with someone who's like leagues ahead of you.
Oh god. The government released a color-coded document. This is the UK government, with kind of their like perceived outcomes of the like initial talks they had earlier in the month. And they've kind of broken it down into a number of sections, with ones marked red that they like definitely disagree on and they need to have actual negotiations. But then a lot of things marked green that I'm not really convinced they definitely agree on. I feel like this might be a lot of presumptions. It's kind of it's interesting that like it's roughly about half are either like of initial talking points are like, we need to negotiate these properly individually because they don't, it's not
it's
not clear what either of them, like, it's kind of, yeah, this, they have, like, this document's quite funny because they have a column being like EU position, UK position, and the UK position often seems to be untenable, and then the EU position seems to be like, no, we don't want things to change. So I can see they're gonna have to talk more about this. Yeah, there's a few things marked green, which are kind of, you know, makes sense. Makes a lot of sense. Like, kind of people, like, obvious points of agreement, like loss of permanent residence status after for UK citizens, etc., tends to be something they, like, roughly agree on because it's, like, straightforward. after it's over, that makes sense. It's not like you can't just randomly move to another country and you have residence,
yeah,
in the EU. But yeah, the actual detail, finer details of that, and like what to do with current people are all marked red, etc. So that's interesting, but not super interesting. It's kind of a, there were talks. They disagree on some things. There will be further talks. Hooray! coming out of this, we mentioned last week that Theresa May is on holidays in Switzerland, walking, in case anyone cares. So while she's away, her cabinet has proceeded to have arguments in the media.
Oh, great.
Which, is kind of, you know, this is kind of just, I feel like this is just continuous deja vu with the UK at these days. Mm-hmm. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, who always looks bored no matter what he's doing, kind of him and Amber Rudd, who's secretary of something but I've forgotten, home secretary, yes, sure, maybe. Let's go with that. They've been touting that there's now like consensus in the cabinet for like a really straightforward transitional deal to put in place after Brexit initially,
yeah,
for 3 years after Brexit, for effectively things to stay basically the same with like some caveats, but like it'll be like this, their wording was off the shelf transition deal. It's going to be like straightforward, basically everything stays the same while we work out fine details of things that aren't part of the like initial breakup deal thing. However, since that, Liam Fox, the international trade secretary, which I believe this government made up, has said that there is consensus on free movement, which would be like a, which was like very heavily implied by Philip Hammond's rhetoric. So this seems to be a you know, fun back and forth between cabinet members.
Yeah.
I would just like to go back again and mention that Liam Fox should not be in the cabinet because of the cabinet he had to like leave in disgrace due to as defense secretary, improperly bringing a friend of his along on trade missions.
There's
people talk a lot about people in Trump's cabinet and him himself being like unqualified for the job. Liam Fox is like categorically unqualified for his job due to having previously had to resign as a high level secretary for internationally bringing someone also unqualified for the job around with him on official business.
Yeah,
and by resigning, avoided any like investigation further into this.
Didn't we have a website planned of where's Liam Fox's friend? It's like probably with Liam Fox.
Yes, let's do that. we have the technology.
Speaking of like a lot of sass and cabinet disagreement, because there were some, I believe, in the last week there was also some discussions of like free movement is definitely going to end after Brexit.
Yeah,
some he says she says kind of things, which I was very skeptical of because I'm like, it's not that simple. Our new Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, got into the fray with this because he was talking about, you know, the border solution, which he kind of very emphatically said, we are not going to help the UK come up with a border solution.
Yeah,
he's like, our proposed solution is that the border should be at the sea, because, you know, like, and he makes the very good point. People who advocate for this make the very good point that you need a form of identification to get onto a ferry or plane anyway. And it would be much easier to check documents when boarding a ferry or plane with goods than it would be to go through our goddamn nebulous border.
Yeah.
That runs through people's like back gardens and towns and stuff.
Yeah, I believe we mentioned in the past that like just after the Brexit vote, someone was asked, oh, how many border checks would you, how many border posts would you require if you were to have a hard border in Northern Ireland? And the response of Vetfield was, we don't know. Nobody knows how many roads there are.
I remember exactly who said that. That was Bertie Ahern, our former teacher.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Of course. He's the guy in charge of our country. He's like, oh, no. Yeah. No, one knows.
No one had heard from him for years. And then he was finally asked the question. He was like, nobody knows anything. What are you talking about?
We all winged it. Could you not tell by my service? But anyway, Leo said this, that like he, you know, is the government position, which I think is very much the Irish position. I don't think like if we suddenly change to a Sinn Féin government tomorrow, I think this would be exactly the exact same position. Would be that the border should be at the sea. When asked about his comments upsetting Downing Street or the DUP, I hope there won't be any angry response from anyone. Anger isn't a policy and anger doesn't lead to solutions, but if anyone is angry, it should be us. They are the ones who want a border. It is up to them to say what it is, to say how it would work, and first of all, convince their own people and their own voters that this is actually a good idea.
Yeah, that's a very valid point of that, so you've joined the EU and agreed to, get rid of an awful lot of, border checks. And then you want to leave the EU, you need to propose a solution that, for starters, that you're definitely happy with, and that everyone, you can get a consensus in Northern Ireland that Northern Ireland is happy with, before you can say, EU sorted out, or, we'll come up with an idea together in negotiations. But you need a proposal, of your best case scenario first. Which is kind of going back to, I believe it was Barnier said, the UK needs to provide a ballpark rough figure of what you're willing to pay to settle your obligations up front. The things you've already agreed to pay for. Yeah. And what is a ballpark cumulative figure that you would be happy with that being? And we can then discuss it. You need to provide a starting point. You can't just say we're going to start negotiations dry with no actual prep, because they need to you need to give a rough figure of what you think the number is, and then we'll work it out. We can't just give you wild numbers, because no matter what the EU says, you're going to say it's too much money.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to put it into a simple context, to be if I came up to you and said, Hugh, we should do a podcast, and then you were oh, okay, cool, what would the podcast be about or look like? And I'd be like, I don't know. But we should definitely make a pot. It's like that. We have seen a lot of this kind of attitude from the UK, where it's like, no, this was your idea. That's also a lot of criticism within the UK, that really should have been in place before the vote happened at all.
Yeah, well, I feel I think there wasn't consensus within any controlling or actually popular political movement what they would agree would be a good idea for it, but they all agree on the idea of leaving. I understand that, and I understand why it's infeasible to have suggested that would happen, but now that there's people who are in charge of the negotiations, they need to come up with a number, and effectively the reason they're not doing it is because whatever number they come up with is politically disastrous for them, because they'll suggest a number, a significant number of their voters will say that seems outrageously high, a lot of the right-wing press will say that seems outrageously high, the EU will say we've worked it out and that's slightly low but roughly close enough.
Oh god, I mean, yeah, it was just, the whole thing was nonsense. I mean, I don't feel like it's too much to ask that back when the referendum was happening, there could have been here's what a Tory Brexit would have looked like. All the people in the Tory party who were in favor of Brexit come together and say, this is what we think it would look like and have to do. I mean, I feel like the Leave campaign ultimately won because of how vague and airy-fairy its policy platform was.
Yeah.
It's, what is Brexit? Brexit is whatever you want it to be.
Yeah, but that's the fact that that's how they won their previous election. It was on the back of, very, very vague reforms and things that didn't didn't have a lot of substance along with them, because they would have ideas of stuff they wanted to do, but not be willing to spend any money on them. Like, yeah. I don't know if you remember the whole big society thing, but effectively it didn't make sense, because it was a policy that sounds like a good idea on paper, but you would actually need to spend a lot of money on it up front for it to be to eventually become self-sustaining as a thing. But you can't just say, like, everyone should do more things in their community. We have some marketing money for it, but we've no, like, there's no tangible thing we're doing with it otherwise. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's just in lighter news, there's been strong implication from Oettinger, the head of the commission? No,
he's commission vice president.
Commission vice president, close enough. Oettinger has said effectively, like, British staff of the European Commission who are, except for, like, the personal staff of the British commissioner, for instance, this wouldn't apply to you, but people who are, like, actual staff in the commission in general, which I think works out to about 1,000 people.
Yeah.
He said that we're not going to ask your resignations. Like, obviously, this is pending residency requirements and stuff that would possibly, like, depending on negotiations, if there's like a hard, for some like worst case scenario, they're all British citizens in the EU have to leave and all EU citizens in the UK have to leave situation, then this probably wouldn't take precedence. But he's saying that, like, as it's looking, they're not going to ask for those people to resign unless there's, like, individual conflicts of interest. Yeah. Then it's fine. There's no reason that, like, current staff of the commission have to quit due to their host country, original country. Sorry, what?
I'm just sorry. It's like, yes, Winslow, there doesn't seem to be any conflict of interest. Oh, thanks, Mr. Oettinger. No problem. Here's your tea. Thanks. Wait, I asked for one sugar. I have sabotaged the team. Rue Britannia.
Yeah. I like the idea of low-level staff of the commission being moles from the UK. Gary, the intern, has been very suspicious lately. It's Nigel Farage and a mustache.
Wearing a lot of trench coats. Yeah.
Oh dear.
Handing brown envelopes around.
Yeah, so that's a not, that's what I would call not negative news.
Not entirely positive.
Yeah.
This is not negative.
Something that I consider to be positive news, but like others consider to be negative or fall into the previous category of not negative, but kind of nothing news, is the UK have announced that they're gonna have a ban on new petrol and diesel cars and vans from 2040 onwards. This is coming from Michael Gove, though, so I don't know how much you can take that. This is following France did this earlier in the month as well, said that's the same date they set. By 2040, there would be no new petrol and diesel cars to be sold. I can't remember the exact details, but I feel like things like hybrids that are like mostly electric, there's probably gonna be some cut off on some of these. Like, the exact details of any legislation
this
isn't clear.
This is not full electric cars only.
Yeah. I think Michael Gove's gave some like reasonably good interviews on this, which was like, he wasn't saying that they would start like banning existing vehicles from roads, etc. It would be more kind of leaving that up to local cities, city governments and things, having like introducing their own restrictions of that nature. But things like banning sales of new cars to like curb the problem is something like the central government is good for, so get the central government to do that, which is kind of a rare time where I see conservative politicians do what it says on the tin, and they're like, oh, local government should have power, but the central government is good for certain things, and they're actually just doing that. And this is a very, because like it would be kind of like, you would have lots, like, as in something like any restrictions you placed on, like, actual driving wouldn't be something that would be very applicable widely across the country. That would be more important in local areas, like individual cities having sections of the city you couldn't drive older cars in, for instance. Yeah. would be the way to do that, because that is where the actual, like, air pollution core problem is. But overall, you need to be, like, curbing it.
Well, there's people who've had, because they talk about, what is it? It's congestion tax in London, isn't it? That's what
that's the congestion called. There's a congestion charge in the centre of London.
Yeah, and they're similar because Stockholm is, like, an archipelago.
Yes.
And, like, to get onto the main island is, like, a series of bridges which are naturally, like, traffic choke points. Mm-hmm. They have fees for getting into that island reduce traffic. That's worked. But people have suggested, like, in high traffic areas like that, like in the congestion tax area zone of London or on the central island of Stockholm, you could do something like no CO2 emitting cars in here.
That's kind of exactly the thing. That or like expanding congestion charge zones as well, like, are also options, because the one in London is, like, relatively small, but it's kind of like the reason you would have for going through it is pretty small. Like, it's one, there's still a lot of traffic, but there's a lot of taxis and people do still drive through it who need to, but it's kind of like, if you're not driving for commercial purposes, there's very little reason why you would need to be driving through central London. One, there's no parking to begin with. Why are you driving? Where are you going to put your car? Driving through the center of London is rarely, like, the correct way to do things. The same way, my memory of Stockholm when I was there is, like, there's not good use cases for having driving through those sections. I don't know what it's like in a lot of other cities, not knowing the layout as well, but kind of like, in the center of Dublin, like, there are often better ways to get to the most places you're going. Yeah, driving into the center, like a lot of people do, but there's often, like, you would drive not the most, the most direct way that happens to go through the very center, where it's, like, if you improved other transport links, you could just park further out and get public transport in. It would make more sense. And prevent as many cars on the road. Anyway, this is off the point. I don't want to talk about city planning anymore.
This is all place City Skylines for a while.
Good game. Well,
good game.
Flawed, but very good game.
When you mod the shit out of it.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm not going to, personally, because I don't have the time. Previously in Europe is produced by Kieran Dold and Hugh O'Brien. This week's music was by me, Hugh. If you like this podcast, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on whatever podcast app you use. It really helps. And tell a friend. This is kind of the only way the podcast grows, is by organically telling people. You can contact us. We're on Twitter. We're at PrevInEurope. And you can email us. We're previouslyineurope@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.